Please join me in welcoming Dr. Lisa Harvey Smith.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much. What a wonderful introduction. I've got a question. What do a crackly telephone line, wireless internet, and Pac-Man have to do with astronomy? Well, tonight we're going to find out. So I'd like to take you on a journey through the history, the cutting edge, and the future of radio astronomy. So a bit of interaction to get to know each other. Who here has used a telescope? Hands up. Oh, brilliant. You're all astronomers. That's fantastic. I should go home. I've also used telescopes. And this is one of my telescopes. It's not my telescope. But this is the kind of telescope I use as a radio astronomer. I use a radio telescope. And people often wonder how they make images of the sky. But you just do the same kind of thing. You use a big dish instead of a big mirror or a big lens. You collect up the waves, bounce them into the middle. Instead of an eyepiece, you use a radio receiver, and off you go. You make pictures of the sky. So these radio telescopes help us to picture the invisible components of the universe. This is what we do when we make astronomical observations. We sit around in dark rooms. This one's like the kind of front desk of a 747, actually. You've got loads of computer screens. You're sitting alone, often through the night, 16 hours observations. So it's a little bit lonely at night, and it's very sad when you have to go and observe on your own. But often, now, instead of doing this, going to a telescope and using the telescope yourself, now we've got internet. We can actually sit at home. You can wear a nice pair of pajamas, sit on your sofa with your laptop, and observe using the world's biggest telescope. And I did just this this year with a nice cup of tea at home. So it's a new age. Astronomy is changing. Astronomy is getting bigger. And astronomy is getting more connected across the world. So radio astronomy has a very interesting past. It wasn't developed by boffins in a university. In fact, it was invented by accident or discovered by accident. And it was discovered when there was a problem and somebody wanted to fix that problem. And that's often when the best science is done, serendipitously, by accident. So what happened in the 1930s was that AT&T, the telephone company, had a research and development lab, and they had a problem, and that problem was that when they sent signals across the Atlantic as telephone calls, they sent those using radio waves. And often, the radio signals were really crackly, and that's quite annoying when you have a hiss, you're trying to talk to your mum in London, or your grandma, and you hear this. You hear that crackling noise. I'm trying to talk here, but all you can hear is this crackling, crackling, crackling in the background. So this industrial problem was sent to the research and development labs called the Bell Laboratories. The Bell Laboratories has actually won 7 Nobel Prizes for physics, more than most universities. So it's an incredibly productive place. And they asked a young engineer called Carl Jansky if he could solve this problem. Why do we have this crackling in the transatlantic communications when we're trying to phone our mum in London? I'm talking about London in England, actually, not London, Ontario. When we're trying to ring our mum in London, England, or in Paris, or in Berlin, wherever they are, we're getting this annoying hissing noise. So they tried to solve this problem by building this incredible contraption, which looks a little bit strange, but is actually the world's first radio receiver that discovered radio waves from space. What happened was Carl Jansky measured the strength of radio waves from all directions. You can see this machine is on a turntable, it's on wheels, and it can spin around and measure the strength of radio waves from different directions. So what he did, he mapped out the radio emission across different directions at different times of day and night. And he did a really good job. This is incredibly what he found. He found that the radio waves were getting much, much stronger every 23 hours and 56 minutes. And that timescale should ring a bell. What's that timescale? Well, it's the timescale that it takes the Earth to rotate once on its axis. It's one day, according to the Earth. So this radio signal was coming from outside the Earth. And this incredible discovery, he realized immediately, was going to be groundbreaking for science. And he actually, Karl Jansky, managed to map out the Milky Way, where he found the radio emission was the strongest. So this amazing picture from, I think, 1936 shows the map of the sky with the constellations on and the radio emission as a band across the Milky Way. So this accidental discovery would normally have led to an increase in scientific activity in this area. But unfortunately, in the late 1930s, war broke out. This actually turned out to be an advancing thing for radio astronomy. So how did that happen? Let's have a look at this old newsreel.
One of the mysteries of wartime science, one of the war's most closely guarded secrets, the miracle of radar, is now revealed. Complicated ground detectors and portable direction finders warn of the approaching enemy and locate him unerringly. Shortwave radio signals sent out and returned as echoes allow the plotting room to spot the target. The cathode tube and intricate setups of electronic devices play major parts in this magic eye of war and peace.
So suddenly during the war, in particular the Allied countries, had a great incentive to develop their understanding of radio waves, their sending out, their reception, and how to use them as a tool, in this case, to map out the positions of warships and airplanes. So there were great advances during the 1930s and 40s in radio science. And this just shows a picture from my part of the world in Sydney, Australia. And this is Dover Heights. This is a clifftop in the north of Sydney, just near Bondi Beach. And you can see a warship in the top right-hand corner there. And this was a radar station during the war. It protected Sydney Harbour. It looked for advancing warships and advancing aircraft that were unknown. So after the war, instead of dismantling this equipment and this expertise that had been built up, instead of doing that, what the Australian government did was set up a laboratory to do science using these skills. And this is one of the telescopes in the early 50s, which was built. So this sort of hole in the ground telescope here, it was about 2.4 meters across. It was a parabolic dish to reflect radio waves from the sky into a receiver. And you can see a young engineer there actually holding a pole using a rickety old wire. And he's pointing the direction of the telescope in the sky, not by moving the dish, but by moving the receiver in the center. And using this, they actually discovered the center of our galaxy, which is a very bright radio source. We now know this has a black hole in the center that's over 1 million times the mass of our sun. So these were the first advances in radio astronomy in Australia, and there were parallel advances in other countries as well. Hope you don't think this is too Australia-centric, but that's where I'm based at the moment, and something to be proud of for everyone. This was the world's first smart telescope in radio astronomy. What they did was they received radio waves from the horizon for objects low in the sky, and then they received the same signal but bounced off the sea. So that actually simulated a much larger telescope, and you could do this cheaply and simply, and they used it as what's called an interferometer to create very fine pinpoint pictures of radio sources which were coming from outside our own galaxy. And they produced the world's first catalogue of these sources. We now know them to be very bright distant galaxies called quasars. And we use them as a celestial reference frame for things like GPS. So when you drive home with your GPS on, well, you probably know where your house is, but wherever you drive with your GPS on, just think about these quasars. And this is about 60 years ago when they discovered them. So that's a little tiny potted history of radio astronomy, and I could do a 10-week lecture series on the history of radio astronomy. But it happened by chance. But now, how do we do astronomy? How do we do astronomy nowadays? Well, this is a beautiful picture of the world's biggest optical telescope right here. This is on top of a mountain in the Canary Islands, and it has a mirror that's over 10 meters across. Now, this telescope can make exquisitely detailed pictures of the sky, and it can do that because the light waves that it's using are very, very small. They're 600 nanometers across in wavelength. So the wavelength of these light waves that are used in this telescope are about 1/30th the width of a human hair, or about 5 flu viruses across. So they're absolutely microscopic. So this is 10 meters across, this mirror. So that means you can fit 17 million light wavelengths into this telescope. And the number of light wavelengths you can cram into your telescope gives you the amount of detail you can see in the image. So that's your simple equation of resolution. By contrast, radio waves are huge. They range in size from millimeters to tens of meters. They're the size of an ant to the size of your car or your house. So the world's biggest radio telescope has to be much bigger to cram the same number of waves into it. So this is the Arecibo radio telescope. This is the one I was using whilst sitting in my pajamas in my lounge room a few weeks ago. So it's a great radio telescope, but at a typical observation using 21 centimeter wavelength radio waves, you can only cram 1,500 waves into that one. So the angular resolution, the amount of detail you can see with this massive telescope is much, much less than that tiny optical telescope, which is only 10 meters across. So we have a problem here. How do we do radio astronomy and make fantastically detailed pictures? We want to do that because we want to see images of galaxies. We want to see images of distant planetary formation systems and loads of other things. We don't need to just see a blob in the sky and say that's interesting, because it's clearly not. So how do we do this? I'm being honest. Well, we cheat. In radio astronomy, it's a cheater's astronomy. It's very, very clever because we use a technique called VLBI, very long baseline interferometry. It's a hideous acronym, but what it means is connecting together telescopes to use them as one giant telescope. So this is just one example of a VLBI network, a network of radio telescopes across the world. There are also ones in all the other countries you can see virtually. And we use them as one. We point at the same object in the sky. We make a picture with each one, and we cross-multiply the signals from each pair of telescopes. And we do a mathematical thing called a Fourier transform, and we make an image of the sky brightness of radio waves across the object we're interested in. So that's the cheater's way to build a giant telescope the size of a continent. In fact, there's currently a satellite in space that's going around the Earth that is a radio telescope as well. So you can connect that one to the ones on Earth and create a virtual telescope the size of the Earth. So it's a very smart way to do science, and that's what we do in radio astronomy to make fantastic pictures. So here's the science bit. What do I mean by discovering the dark universe? The universe, the more we learn about the universe, the less we know. So we've been using telescopes since, I can't tell you the answer because you had a quiz about this, but we've been using the telescopes for over 400 years, and thousands of astronomers have spent millions of hours staring at the sky, recording what they've seen. And the sum knowledge of all those people's effort, all the smartest people in the world have put their minds to this, is basically that the universe looks like Pac-Man. I apologize if you're too young for Pac-Man or too old, but I don't think that really covers too many people. 4% stuff, 96% mystery. And the people who know what I'm talking about will have seen a similar chart to this, maybe not colored the same way. So we understand that the universe has matter and energy within it. And the stuff that we can see is only 4% of the whole story. And then the next few slides, I'd like to explain what I mean by that. But first, let's go to how we know that. How do we know the universe looks like Pac-Man? Well, this is a series of pictures made of distant galaxies. They're actually not very, very distant galaxies. They're ones in our cosmic neighborhood. And these pictures have been made using radio telescopes. And one of the things that emits radio waves in space is cold hydrogen gas. Hydrogen's the most abundant element in the universe. So it's a good tracer of the cold material. You know, there's obviously other elements out there. But hydrogen really tells us, we look at hydrogen, we know where the rest of the stuff is. Now, these are nice pictures of spiral galaxies. You'll notice the spiral structures. Some of them are edge-on almost, so they look a bit flatter. Some of them look very round because they happen to be face-on to us. But this is a wonderful way that radio astronomy can tell us what galaxies look like in the cold gas instead of the hot stars that are seen by optical and other types of telescopes. We can do a clever trick with looking at radio waves from hydrogen as well. We can actually use them. The emission is a very narrow wavelength range at 21 centimeters wavelength. And if something that is emitting that light at 21 centimeters wavelength is moving away from us, it's redshifted, the light is stretched. And if it's moving towards us, the light is compressed. And this is much like when an ambulance goes past you, you hear the pitch of the siren change. As the ambulance comes towards you, the pitch goes up. As it retreats, it goes, it stretches. So in much the same way, we can make images of galaxies and we can measure their rotation. So it's a very clever way to measure the amount of mass in the galaxy and the distribution of the mass, just by using Newton's laws and Kepler's laws. So sort of high school physics, you can measure how heavy a galaxy is. So if you do this, you find something really, really weird is going on. Something really strange is going on. So if you just look at Newton's laws of motion, just the simple gravity for things that aren't moving really, really fast, you see the theoretical rotation curve is on the left. The velocity, that's the speed of the motion of gas when it's rotating around a galaxy, is large towards the center of the galaxy, and then as you go out from the center to the edge, the velocity goes down. So the stuff at the outside is ambling around slowly. The stuff in the middle is whizzing around fast. But on the right-hand side, you see the actual rotation profile. So how the galaxy is actually rotating when you measure that rotation through radio waves from hydrogen atoms. And in almost all galaxies that we've ever looked at, the stuff in the middle is traveling at the same speed as the stuff at the edge. It's completely wacky. We don't understand why. And this mystery is one piece of the puzzle to understanding why we have a Pac-Man universe. One of the explanations is there's too much mass in the galaxy. There's mass we can't see, and that mass is called dark matter. And the dark matter is making the gas around the edge of the galaxy whiz around really fast. We'll come to that later. There's more evidence for this strange dark missing matter, and that is gravitational lensing. So I'll illustrate this just very simply. When a football or a soccer ball hits the back of the net, no, actually, when a hockey puck hits the back of the net, sorry, in the wrong country. When a hockey puck hits the back of the net, the hockey puck has energy, and that energy is imparted into the net, and the net bends around it. Okay, so it produces a force, and the net bends around it to accommodate that. Now, there are people in the early 1900s, including Einstein and others, who said, actually, space is like this. Space and time is like a net. And when something, an object, has mass, like a star or a galaxy, when it has a weight and a mass and gravitational attraction to other masses, space-time actually bends around it like this. So your hockey puck is, say, a star, and the net is the space-time continuum, which we all know it looks like a net, you see something like this. You see bending of light along the bending of the space-time continuum. So when we look at the sun and there's a star behind it, in fact, the light is bent around the sun. And people have done experiments to show this during solar eclipses. So this happens in space and we see it. And it's another way to weigh matter, to see how much mass is out there, how much stuff is out there. This is an example of a gravitational lens taken from the Hubble Space Telescope. The Hubble Space Telescope is a relatively small telescope, but in space it's absolutely wonderful because you don't have the atmospheric distortions. And you can see not only the normal galaxies, but there are all these stretchy lines. And the stretchy lines are gravitationally lensed images of background objects caused by the gravitational potential well, that is the bending of space and time, like the net, by a foreground object. And you can use sophisticated techniques, mathematics, computer modeling and simulations to actually work out how much mass is in the foreground, in the lensing object, and how that's distributed. And when you compare that to the amount of light that's coming out, the mass is way, way more than the amount of light that you see. And that tells you that It's not just stars and the galaxy that's bending the light. It's loads and loads of dark, unseen matter as well. So this is another example of missing mass. Here's another beautiful picture of another gravitational lens. And we see hundreds of these, absolutely wonderful. And there's a lot of great science you can do. So the conclusion from these and other observations tell you that 83% of the mass in the universe is hiding from us. We just don't know where it is. And it's called dark matter. But that's just an excuse. We don't know what it is. We just give it a name. Nonsense. So we think, from the spinning galaxy arguments, that galaxies have a halo of dark matter around them. And clusters of galaxies, we think, have a halo of dark matter surrounding the galaxies. And dark matter may be composed of all sorts of things, exotic particles, things we can't see, but all we know is it doesn't interact with light, it doesn't absorb or emit light, but it has a gravitational attraction to other matter. So that's the dark matter. That doesn't tell us the whole story. There's more. These three guys, this year, won the Physics Nobel Prize for this discovery. This discovery that, in the past, you know, the universe is expanding. You've seen Monty Python, right? So, or the Big Bang Theory, if you're young. And the universe is expanding. It's getting, everything in the universe is getting further and further apart on large scales. And it has been from the very beginning. And that's how we know, we think there was a Big Bang in the beginning when everything was crammed together. Now, if you do measurements of supernova, and you may have seen a talk by Brian Schmidt a little while ago explaining this, one of the Nobel Prize winners, but in the past, the universe was expanding more slowly than it is nowadays. So the expansion of the universe is getting faster and faster. In other words, we're trapped on a runaway roller coaster, and we can't get off. So it's a strange thing. We don't understand why this is happening, but we, again, have given it a name. So these are some of the names that are ascribed to this kind of thing, but we call it dark energy nowadays. So this is the in vogue name for this effect. The expansion of the universe is getting faster and faster. Everything is whizzing apart more quickly. Not everyone's happy with it. So, you know, if an effect has a t-shirt, then it's real. So, if you take the matter and the energy, E equals mc squared, energy and matter are interchangeable, so not just the mass, but the energy as well in the universe. This is essentially the breakdown. If you color those bits in yellow, that's your Pac-Man diagram. The universe is 4% normal stuff. Call it baryonic matter there. 23% dark matter, all the gravitational pulls that we can't see, we can't explain. And 73% is dark energy, which is pushing us down a precipice on a roller coaster. So it's a strange universe, that's all we can say. So how on earth do we get from this picture, we don't know what the universe is made of, how do we keep our astronomy grants? How do we keep our jobs? This is a scandal, right? So what can we do about it? How am I going to keep my job? Well, what we've got to do is make movies of the universe. We've got to see how the things we can see, that 4% that we can see, how that stuff is affected by the 96% we can't see. So we need to build a cosmic time machine, essentially. But luckily, that's simple. In the olden days, messages were sent at the speed of horse. If there was an important message to send, it would travel slowly by a man on a horse, and eventually that message would reach its recipients. There was no Twitter, there was no instant messaging, and this was how things worked. But nowadays, things travel at the speed of light. Light goes incredibly quickly. If you shoot a light ray out, it would travel around the equator 8 times in a second. It's incredibly fast. But when you start thinking on bigger scales than the Earth, it doesn't seem so quick. It takes 8 minutes for a light ray to get from the surface of the Sun to the Earth. So in fact, by the time you see the start of a solar flare, well, it's already happened 8 minutes ago. So how does this work with even greater distances? Well, let's say the nearest galaxy, there's a supernova explosion, a new star is formed. And this horseman, of course, now going at the speed of light, very, very fast. It takes 2 million years for that message to be received at Earth. In essence, our telescopes are seeing old news. You wouldn't buy a newspaper from 2 million years ago, but that's what we're doing in astronomy. Of course, you can extend this to even more distant galaxies. There weren't horses back then. So the further back into space we look, the older the news we're looking at. Good, I'm glad that's clear. So this is the first picture ever made. This is the oldest picture, and the oldest picture we can ever hope to take. This is a real picture of the early universe, the cosmic microwave background radiation. So the universe when it was just becoming transparent to light. And what this really shows you is fluctuations in temperature or density. It's incredibly, incredibly smooth, the universe, about 300 to 400,000 years after the Big Bang. The red bits are slightly, slightly hotter than the blue bits, maybe slightly, slightly more dense in some regions than the other. So this was kind of the seed of the structure in the universe. That's what we think. So the structure in the early universe was incredibly subtle. It wasn't a blank slate, but some bits were slightly more clumpy than others. And we think that this manifested forward has actually created structure in our modern galaxy. And what we can do is do computer simulations. So you get the mathematics of physics, the gravity, cosmology, all the things we think we know about the universe. How does gravity work? You know, how much dark matter is there? And you can make a model, starting with this and going to the present day, and you shove in 2 billion dark matter particles, and what you get is a beautiful simulation, a fly-through like this. And each dot on this is a simulation of the real visible matter. So each one of these particles is a galaxy. And the simulation was done based on particles of dark matter, and we assume that the dark matter and the visible matter are in the same place because they're attracted to one another. So what we're doing now is looking at the structure, the large-scale structure of the universe. And this is an enormous supercluster of galaxies, millions or billions of galaxies all together in a massive cluster surrounded by dark matter. And as we go towards the center, you can see it gets much denser, where all these filaments are meeting. And when we zoomed out again, we could see that the universe has voids where there are no galaxies, and then areas called filaments where there are lots and lots of galaxies in organized structures. And this, remember, is a simulation of what our universe should look like now in terms of the continuum of galaxies throughout space. It's very beautiful. So what we want to do as astronomers is make observations to see if this picture, this theoretical picture of the universe, is correct, because we've made the first picture of the universe with a slight changes in temperature and structure, and we fast-forwarded that using the theories, the physics that we think is correct, and we've made this pretend universe. So how do we actually make this pretend universe into a real movie of the universe? How do we observe this stuff? Well, we have to look back in time. We've just seen we can look back in time. We just look further and further away, and we see the dinosaur messenger and the horse messenger coming to us, telling us what the universe looks like, billions of light years away. So it is possible. This is an actual picture of the local universe, and each point is a galaxy. The Earth's in the middle, so what we're seeing is a slice of the sky in each direction, forward and back. Now, the Earth's in the center, so the points towards the edge of the image are further away from the Earth, and the points towards the center are closer to us. So this shows you the structure of galaxies in our local universe. And you can see it looks like the simulation. It looks like that purple structure of filaments and then voids. So it looks pretty similar. But all we know is what the galaxies look like in the very local universe, what they look like today. What we want to do is look at the historical picture and make a movie of the universe evolving and changing. And the physics will come out of that. What we can do if we have an incredibly sensitive telescope that can see very, very far objects is look at something like this. This is a simulation of when the universe was incredibly smooth. And the blackness is just cold hydrogen. And what you can see is from a smooth universe composed of cold gas, the first stars and galaxies form. And they form because there are changes in density caused by those changes in density in the early universe, and then gravity pulsing together creates stars, creates galaxies, and stars and galaxies are hot, they emit UV radiation, and therefore they ionize the surrounding regions. And what you can see in the blue is all those ionization regions just emerging and pricking little holes in this wonderful smooth cosmic fabric that we started with. And you end up in the epoch of reionization, when the first stars and galaxies are born. And we want to understand things like, where did the first black holes come from? How did they come about? So all these things require us to look back in time, check, we can do that, to make a movie, and a movie is just a series of still pictures. So if we look at different distances into the universe, we can actually take those pictures at different ages of the universe and make that movie. So we have hope, but as long as we can build a telescope sensitive enough to actually see that far in the first place. So the idea is to build this amazing radio telescope. And the radio telescope can see the cosmic dark ages when the universe was completely, almost completely smooth. And then the first hot stars and hot galaxies ionize those regions and burn out the hydrogen and turn them into ions. And this telescope will also have to look deep, deep into space and make images of literally billions of galaxies so we can make this wonderful movie of the cosmic structures as they evolve and change through the universe. We also have to remember about redshift that changes the wavelength of the hydrogen line at 21 centimeters. So we have to look at wavelengths shorter than 21 centimeters, and we have to look at wavelengths longer. So this whole range of things that the telescope has to be able to do. Another thing it has to do is look at the whole sky. You can't just peer through a telescope and look at a tiny region of sky and just be happy with that. We've got to look at what the whole sky looks like to make these wonderful movies. So it's a huge wish list. And to do this, we have to build a very special telescope, one that spans an entire continent. Remember the cheating method of joining together telescopes? Well, we have to use that. We have to have a large collecting area, much, much larger than that Arecibo radio telescope that I used in my pajamas. We have to have a whole square kilometer of collecting area to see the very first stars and galaxies forming. We have to also look at a large wavelength range, which means using different types of radio telescopes, some that look like dishes and some that look like little dipoles on the ground, which are slightly more old-fashioned looking, but actually very, very high-tech. So let me show you a movie of the idea that the international radio astronomy community has for this wonderful new telescope called the Square Kilometer Array. exciting enough? I love that video. Wonderful. So you thought there were three receptor types of the dishes, and there were two types of low-frequency arrays, so they could look at a broad range of wavelengths, and it was spread right across a continent, a size of 3,000 kilometers, which is needed to see very detailed images of galaxies in the far-off universe. The sort of things this radio telescope will be able to do if we build it is to make images of very distant objects incredibly quickly. It's so sensitive. So this is an image of the closest massive galaxy to us, an active galaxy called Centaurus A. So that's the purple that you can see on the right-hand side. And it was taken with the Australian Telescope Compact Array, which is six dishes in Australia. And it's an excellent telescope, very sensitive, but this particular image that you can see here, which is the best of its kind anywhere in the world, took a mosaic, different pointings, like stitching together of different pictures, 400 different pictures. It took 1,200 hours of observing over 3 years and a huge amount of work to make this. And with the Square Kilometre Array, the new telescope that we're proposing, you would take this in one image. In other words, you would have a wide field of view and you'd be able to see this whole thing in one shot, and it would take 5 seconds. So it's not just a gradual improvement. This is a huge leap in our technology, enabling us to do some incredible things, and certainly not just taking pictures of things we already know what look like, but this is a wonderful example of how quick it will be. Now, all these telescopes, 3,000 dishes, about 10,000 of those little dipoles, these all generate data. The radio waves are received, they're turned into digital electrical signals, and they're sent through fiber optic cables underground to a supercomputer. And that supercomputer then deals with the data in the ways that astronomers need to produce a useful output. Now, these data challenges for the Square Kilometre Array, all these dishes, all these arrays, bringing together 100 terabits per second. So that's all the data that's shooting down all the pipes from all the telescopes coming into a supercomputer at 100 terabits per second. The brain of the telescope is the supercomputer, and it will have to do a large number of calculations per second. We don't know exactly the number because we don't know exactly how we'd design this telescope, but it's a very, very big number. And we'll generate 5 exabytes of data per day. 5 exabytes of data. Let me put that into context. That's 10 times the internet, the total global internet traffic today. So this telescope will generate more data than everyone in the world, sending all the information through the internet currently. It's a massive, massive technology challenge. But luckily, large companies are helping us to try and drive forward the technology advancements that will help us to do this. There's another challenge, and that is telescopes are very, very sensitive. Imagine you shined a laser in someone's eye. Well, your eye is damaged. It's seriously blinding. And the same problem exists with radio telescopes. If somebody uses a mobile phone near a radio telescope, the signal drowns out the astronomical signals by billions of times. A mobile phone on Pluto would be a reasonably strong source for radio telescopes. It's incredible. So this is a picture of the Earth by night, and this shows you just the light pollution from the Earth. And this is showing you where people live, where there's human activities. So you can see there's a few places on Earth where there is less human activity. So we need to pick one of those places that is suitable for the telescope site. There's a power challenge. The telescope might be limited by the amount of power we have. We need to put the telescope in a remote area so we don't have this radio pollution from humans, from machines, from all the things that you have with you tonight, your mobile phone, your computer. Everything we do as humans generates this radio interference. And the telescope being in a remote area means that it's less likely you have a large power station nearby. So to generate the power required for these supercomputers, just to run the telescopes, to cool the electronics, to do all the associated things that you need to do when you build a large infrastructure and large pieces of machinery, very difficult to do. The central area of the square kilometer array will have about 1,500 dishes and around 10,000 other low-frequency pieces of equipment. And it may well have a large computing center as well. And the power it will need just to work all those pieces of equipment is about 65 megawatts, the equivalent around the number of people in Kitchener. So this will be like a very large community. The remote telescopes will be in large groups spread around the continent wherever the telescope is sited. And these will require the power of about 100 homes, just a small community. And of course, radio telescopes work night and day. You can see the optical sky only at night. You can see the radio sky night and day. So these things will work 24/7. We need a lot of power. So there's a big challenge. So how do we meet those challenges? Well, what we do as an international community, we intend to build this amazing instrument. We want to do amazing science with it. So what we've done is come together, all the countries involved in this project have come together and decided to build Pathfinder telescopes, practice instruments to demonstrate the technology, to demonstrate the ability to run instruments in remote areas, to demonstrate all sorts of things. So these are some of the precursor and Pathfinder, the practice-run telescopes, developing these new technologies, demonstrating how to do the science with these things. Just getting ready for the SKA is probably 20 projects in all around the world, and these things are going on right now. They're being built, and they're being used by people. So these are just some of these projects. This one in the center at the bottom is the 500-meter aperture spherical telescope. This is not yet built. This is a mock-up, but it's going to be in China. 500 meters across. It's absolutely huge. The one in Puerto Rico is 300 meters across. So this is demonstrating the ability to build receivers for large dishes. This one is an upgrade of a special cross-shaped kilometer-long telescope in Australia. The South Africans have built a 7-telescope demonstrator and are expanding that to over 60 dishes. And there are lots of low-frequency arrays using different technologies, different ideas about how to do the science. So this is wonderful. The international community is coming together to really try and make this project a reality. But I work for the CSIRO, which is the Australian Government's Research Lab, and we do astronomy and we build telescopes and we run telescopes as national facilities and international facilities. So I'm going to talk about our Pathfinder effort, which is called the Australian SKA Pathfinder, or ASCAP. ASCAP is a 36-dish demonstrator for the SKA. And in the same way that the other Pathfinder projects are trying to address certain issues and tackle certain challenges for the SKA, these are the types of challenges that we're addressing. So we've chosen to try and find a new observatory that's extremely radio quiet and establish that for radio astronomy. We're building remote infrastructure, so looking at those challenges. Using cutting-edge technologies, which I'll explain later, special radio cameras that have been invented recently. Working on the assumption that the SKA will try and use 100% green energy. And this is really good news. And looking at data transport and computing, huge amounts of data coming from a very remote site into supercomputers, which will have to then process those data to enable astronomers to do science. And of course, the projects are completely international, so we have over 350 scientists all over the world getting ready to use the ASCAP telescope. And it'll consist of 36 dishes. So we've established the Murchison Radio Astronomy Observatory, which is in the west of Australia. It's called the Murchison Radio Astronomy Observatory because it's in the Murchison Shire. The Shire is like a sort of council region. But this council region is absolutely huge. It's 50,000 square kilometers, about the size of Nova Scotia, and it has 100 people living there. It's absolutely incredible. It's a very, very low population density, and that means there is a radio quiet environment. We don't have interference from people's mobile phones and other things. In addition to the already being radio quiet, we've established radio quiet protection through legal means. And this is what the site looked like a couple of years ago. It's fantastic. Just arid land. It's not quite desert, but it's extremely hot in the summer. And it's a magical kind of place. And at this point, I like to say that the Wadjuri Yamaji people of Australia are the traditional owners of this site. And I'd like to tell you just a couple of minutes about the Wadjuri Yamaji people. Aboriginal people of Australia have probably the longest uninterrupted culture on Earth. It's about 40 to 60,000 years that these people have had continuous culture. The Wadjuri people have their own language, which is still spoken. They have their own customs and traditions, and they're astronomers and artists also. There's currently an exhibition of Wadjuri art, which was developed in collaboration with astronomers in Australia to try and celebrate the traditional stories to do with the sky in the Wadjuri culture. So a lot of us have grown up in the Western world where we assume that constellations, groups of stars, are named after the Greek traditions, the ancient Greeks. So things like the Big Dipper, the real name, the Ursa Major, and Orion, the hunter, these are all based on stories from ancient Greece. But the Wadjuri people have their own constellations and their own stories and actually very practical reasons for choosing these constellations. So what you can see here is a painting by Margaret Whitehurst, and it's called The Emu in the Sky. And the emu is a wonderful story, and it's shared by a number of Aboriginal peoples across Australia. And the right-hand picture shows you why there is an emu in the sky. The band of light known as the Milky Way shows you all the stars in our galaxy, in the galactic disk. But there are also dark clouds in the galaxy, and these absorb light. One of them is famous, it's called the Coalsack. But in a very dark sky, and without the streetlights that you have in cities, you can see this clear emu in the dark clouds in the Milky Way, and it's absolutely phenomenal. Once it's pointed out to you, you can't not see it anymore. I'm completely ruined for Western constellations now. All I see is this emu in the sky. So the emu in the sky is a tradition, and it's when it is in a particular direction, when it rises over a particular landmark, the people know that the emu eggs are ready and they can go and collect them and get a good feed. So this emu is very important. I thought I'd tell you about that because this is Wadjuri land, and they very, very kindly let us use it for an observatory. So a few years ago, it looks like this. And then 2 weeks ago, I went over, took some journalists to the site to have a look, and we have 30 telescopes. 36 is the total number, and they will all be delivered on site and all be installed by the end of this month, hopefully. So this is a working observatory now. We've dug 380 kilometers of fiber optic cables. We've linked up all these telescopes. There are actually two different Pathfinder telescopes on site, and all this in a completely remote area, hundreds of kilometers from the nearest town. It's really demonstrating some of the things we'll need to do for this amazing project. This is how you dig a trench and put fiber optic cable in. If you want to send the signals down a cable, you've got to dig it underground. You can see a huge reel of cable on the back, which is the fiber optic cable in a blue cladding. And then a huge ripper goes down the road, cuts a hole, and then puts the cable in, and then covers itself up. So it's a very efficient process, and we got pretty good at this. Here's a close-up of some of the dishes. And these are very special dishes, too. They move in three axes. They move up and down in the sky, left and right across, and they twist on their heads like this. And the reason is it makes it much easier to calibrate the images to make a really high quality image if you can just follow an object in the sky without moving these struts that keep the receiver up in the middle at different angles to the sky. So innovations such as that are making this a more powerful telescope. The most powerful innovation with ASCAP is probably the receivers. Normally, when you use a telescope, imagine you're standing on the beach and you're looking at a distant object, maybe it's a ship. You put a telescope up to your eye, and what can you see? You should see the ship's bigger, but you also can't see the rest of the world. All you can see is this ship. So a field of view of a magnified object is very small. So normally with a telescope, you have a receiver and you can point the telescope in any particular direction, and you just see that piece of sky, a very small area. But if we want to survey the whole sky for billions of galaxies to understand how dark matter works and dark energy, then we have to build a smarter receiver that can see large areas of the sky. So that's what this is. This kind of funny green thing that looks like a checkerboard is a phased array feed radio receiver. It's a radio camera that can see a wide field of view. So it's like when you put a fisheye lens or a wide-angle lens on your camera. And this man's called John O'Sullivan. He's an engineer with us in Sydney. And he's led the team that's developing these phased array feeds through this checkerboard design for next-generation telescopes. He's also a very smart guy. In the past, he led a team which has enabled over 3 billion devices around the world, the types that you and I use every day, like your mobile phones and your computers, to work wirelessly with fast, reliable Wi-Fi. And this guy put a patent on Wi-Fi, and it's been extremely successful. And that's all I'll say. So that's the challenge, technology challenge, and that's how smart people like John are solving it. There's also the renewable energy challenge. We don't want to pollute the world. We don't want to mess it up. We want to use renewable energy. And certainly in remote areas, in hot climates or in windy places, renewable energy can be very viable. In the arid areas of Western Australia, it's very warm. You get a lot of sunshine. You don't get a lot of clouds. You don't get a lot of rain. So we used hybrid power station, like this mock-up, which is just a proposal for a possible power station for ASCAP, which uses half photovoltaic cells, which are solar cells, and half diesel. And hopefully this will be improved in the future when we have good storage solutions, because, of course, the sun's only up half of the time, and the rest of the time it's dark, and you have to rely on some other power unless you can store it well. So we're pushing. We're trying to push the boundaries of renewable energy in remote areas through this SKA project. We're using geo-exchange cooling as well. In a very hot environment, things like electronics can be cooled. This is a picture of using a system like that to dump heat down into a rock. So the outside temperature is 42 degrees, 100 Fahrenheit, something like that. It's too hot. You can't air condition in those conditions. So you send the heat downwards. It's only 25 degrees below in the rock. So you can do that kind of thing, geo-exchange. This is a picture that I took again from the air a couple of weeks ago. You can see the telescopes in the background, and this is the control building for ASCAP. And this will contain rooms and rooms full of computers, CPUs, racks and racks of CPUs, just computer, computer, computer. And those generate loads of heat. So again, we're dumping the heat from that building into the ground, and that whole flat area you can see in the foreground with a tractor has just been covering up the geothermal wells that have been dug in the last few months. So we're going to send the energy, send the heat down into the earth and try and make this energy efficient. Now, the Square Kilometer Array is an international project, and all these countries are involved. All these countries are paid up. The latest member is Canada. Yay. Thank you. So you have 8 countries paid up members, many more countries as associate members or involved in the project to build this amazing continental-sized telescope. So the future is very bright. Now, there is currently a decision that is being awaited as to where the telescope will be sited. So we have to wait maybe a couple more months before we know exactly where it will be built. Then we can move on and do detailed designs and get the lessons from our Pathfinder telescopes and try and roll those into building the best possible SKA that we can. So this telescope is not only looking into the universe, it's not only looking at stars and galaxies and black holes, it's also pushing the boundaries in technology, meeting global challenges. We're looking at renewable energy. We're demanding that companies look for solutions to our problem. We need 65 megawatts of power, and we need it out somewhere, not near anyone's house, not near any businesses. So you've got to find us a solution. So that's a good thing. We've got to transport massive, massive amounts of data. It's frightening. More than the whole internet usage of the world has to go through our fiber optic cables, and we have to process and store those data in some way. So we're pushing the boundaries in high-performance computing, in data transport, and in things like radio receivers, John's checkerboard. So all those things will have applications and spin-offs, hopefully, in digital signal processing as well, electronics, all those things that make our lives a little bit easier. But I'll just finish off with the exploration of the unknown. When people ask me what the most important thing the SKA will discover is, I say, it's something we haven't even thought of yet. Because that's how, if you look at any history, that's how things happen, that's how great discoveries are made. Someone doesn't clean their bench and goes on holiday, a chemist, and oh, my petri dish is covered in fuzz, I've invented penicillin. You know, things like that happen by chance. And this telescope is pushing the boundaries in so many directions, and so many smart scientists are trying to figure out what we're going to discover. It's very exciting. So the Pac-Man universe, hopefully more than 4%, will be understood by the end of this. Thank you so much for your attention. I look forward to your questions. It's been lovely talking to you tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Harvey Smith. So, do we have a question? If not, we can go straight to the Twitter feed. Oh, I see some right there.
There's been a lot of discussion recently, I think of the Wired magazine that just is out this month, about the kinds of analysis of massive exabytes of data. Is that kind of technology and those explorations, are they part of what you're doing as well? It seems to me that there would be overlaps of large amounts.
Absolutely. That's a great question about the amount of data. And there are expert communities within our project who are dealing with software and computing, and they're engaging very heavily with the expert companies, so the industry working with the scientists, to actually develop solutions for these challenges. So that's one of the major challenges, really, is how we deal with this torrent of data drinking from the fire hose, if you will. So it's an excellent question, and yeah, people are working really hard with industry partners to try and solve these problems. But if you look at the extrapolation of computing power, the biggest supercomputers in the world, and you extrapolate that forward, in fact, we look like we're going to reach that ability by the time we actually build this telescope in about 2024. So I think people who are expert in this, which is certainly not me, are very confident that we can reach that level by the time we build the telescope.
Thank you. Let's go to the question on my left.
Given the nature of politics, which country is likely to be the location of all this knowledge, or is it all electronic and you don't need a central core?
That's a good question. We have 2 possible sites for this telescope. wherever it's sited, wherever the organization decides to put it, all those countries will have equal access to the data, and people around the world will be able to do science. The data will probably be distributed in some way because a central storage facility may be too large or too risky. So people are looking at solutions of distributed computing, and all those kinds of things will be developed over the next 15 years, and I guess we'll find some fantastic solutions for that.
And a question here to my right.
Good on you, mate.
Cheers, mate.
Great. Great presentation.
Thank you.
You mentioned that Canada was a paid-up contributor. Are there any things under construction in Canada like you have in the west of Australia?
Yes. Canada has a phased array feed demonstrator as well. So Canada is very skilled in receivers and electronics for radio astronomy and has a number of labs. And you guys are developing a phased array feed with a different design to ours, and it has different specifications. So, in fact, three or four different groups around the world are designing those feeds. So those things will be put on some telescope in the future, and they'll be tested in different ways and then modified to try and make something the final goods for the SKA. Yeah.
I'll go to the Twitter feed. The data you've impressed upon us is definitely a theme. So
yeah.
This is a related question. From Bob Doyley, with the amount of data that the SKA will gather, are new computer science algorithms needed, or is it purely just processing power?
I think that new algorithms will have to be developed. The way we do radio astronomy at the moment requires very specialist algorithms, just to do things like the cross-multiplication and transforms. And if we can develop new, faster ways to do that, then that's fantastic. But also, we're doing things like when you make images, you won't have humans looking at them anymore. You'll have machines looking at them and source finding. So you get a huge area of sky, and you can't pay 8 million graduate students to just have a look through and find stuff for you. So what you have to do is, you know, use automated source finding algorithms, all those kinds of things, to detect the types of things you're looking for, to get the science out. So those algorithms will have to be developed as well. And we're currently working on that for the Pathfinder projects in a small scale, in a 1% SKA scale, and that will have to be scaled up in the future.
Thank you. Let's take two more questions. We'll go first to my left, and then we'll finish on my right.
In the movie flyover of the antennas, they appeared to me to be just sprinkled around at random.
Yeah.
I rather doubt that. Can you comment on how you go about figuring out the pattern to put them in?
Absolutely. That's a great question. Someone asked me that earlier as well. In radio interferometry, where you have lots of antennas, if you space them equally, then you actually don't make a very good picture. You have to cross-multiply the signals from each pair of antennas. And if they're spaced equally, you're getting redundant information. So it's a complicated and long-winded topic, which I may talk about at great length and bore everyone. But in fact, as it happens, if you space the antennas in some random fashion in the center and then in spiral arms going out from the center, you can make a really good image. There are some telescopes that are aligned with different dishes in a straight line, east-west. There are some that are in a Y shape, like the VLA in New Mexico. So dish design, array design can vary, but essentially, you don't normally want sort of grid patterns because you can't make a very good image because you have this redundant information. So yeah, it's complicated science, but it's all to do with the way you cross-multiply the data between the dishes.
And our last question at the back.
Okay, I was just wondering, you said that there was going to be a big supercomputer that was going to be handling all the data. It takes a giant amount of cooling to keep that computer from completely melting. Like, I know the world record overclocking was at 8.3 gigahertz, and they had to pour liquid nitrogen on the motherboard to keep it, or whatever they were using to overclock it, to keep it cool enough to run. So I was just wondering, how are you planning to cool the computer enough or the computers enough to make it possible to get all that data and process it?
Good question. We don't know. But the real answer is, well, that is the real answer, but no, a good answer is that we're building supercomputer centers right now for ASCAP, for the 1% of the SKA of 36 dishes. So what we're doing is installing geothermal geo-exchange cooling systems there as a prototype to try and see if that works. There are also ideas, I mean, we may not be able to use CPU computing anyway, maybe GPUs or something like that, graphics processing units. So we don't actually know how we're going to handle the computing. But in terms of cooling, I mean, you have to do air conditioning and all those kinds of things for regular supercomputers. But goodness knows is the answer. And whoever those smart people who are developing the supercomputers, who I highly suspect will be people like you when when you're working in that industry, then you'll have to figure out those smart ideas.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's thank Dr. Lisa Harvey-Smith.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.